Portions of the day's programming are reproduced by means of electrical transcriptions or tape recording.
Hello, Chicago!
You should sit. This is bad.
Laurel. Laurel.
We have to remember, as much as this is the pomp and pageantry of a great royal wedding and the last great wedding for a generation, it's also a personal and private occasion.
You are my Lebanese lover, Pete.
New day is on the horizon!
My 720 WGN, 419, Sunday afternoon. Pete McMurray with you. I don't know about you, but I just am so sick of this weather. I want to punch somebody in the neck. I want to tell you. Pam, good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good afternoon. I'm ready for a throat shot, too. This is ridiculous. I'm tired of the cold. I'm tired of the rain.
I walked out of my house this morning to walk my dog. It started raining, and I had to drive my son to Aurora today for a basketball tournament.
Ooh, what time?
Good times. I think I was there at 9 a.m. in Aurora.
Wow.
And I got the call that said the White Sox are going to end early. You better get your butt down to the radio station. So I booked it down 88 to the Eisenhower, and here I am. That construction by UIC is a pain in the butt.
Right?
I know we always say this, it's construction season, but I just don't understand. Okay, so it went from three lanes or four lanes to three. Just keep moving. Why do you have to slow down?
I don't know. I mean, I feel that way on most highways, though. Like, don't hit the brakes unless there's an emergency.
Everybody's,
you know what I mean?
Hitting the brakes. They're slowing down. We're all in a hurry, but I just don't understand it. Coming up at right after 4:30, I want to talk about tips. Something happened to me today. Everybody wants a tip. Everybody wants a handout. And I see the jar everywhere, but I saw it today at a place that should not have been. And I feel like we all over tip, and there's tip jars everywhere we go. We'll talk about that at 4:35. We have an author that's coming in studio. His name is Russ Bradbird. He wrote the book All Dreams We've Dreamed. He's been a basketball coach for the last 30 years, and he turned author. One of the greatest anthem singers in Chicago. Anthem singer, of course, Jim Cornelison. Who's number two? Anybody? Pam, anything come to mind?
I got nothing.
Anything? Oh, no. Where's your... Oh, wait.
How's that?
There you go.
Would it be the guy who can hold the note, John Vincent?
John Vincent will be in studio right after 6 o'clock. The big man, John Vincent. He's got such a great story. He's been singing at Ditka's for years and years and years. And then finally the Cubs called and said, hey, do you want to sing a national anthem? And next thing you know, he's singing at the World Series. And now he's got a new platform where he's talking about bullying. He's just one of the best people in Chicago. John Vincent will be in studio. And if you're thinking about traveling Memorial Day weekend, which a lot of us are, we get in our cars, we drive somewhere, we go to somebody's house. But if you're thinking about getting on a plane, we will have travel expert Amy Tara Koch in studio, and she will help you. We all go on trips on airplanes, and we all overpack, don't we? We all overpack. I'm an overpacker. I come from a long line of overpackers. Why do we overpack? I don't understand, but we do. That's just the way it is. So we'll talk to Amy Tara Koch. Okay. Did anybody watch the royal wedding yesterday? 312-981-7200 is my phone number. If you saw it, I'd love to hear from you. That's our text line, 312-981-7200. Also our phone line. Pam, did you watch the royal wedding yesterday?
I so wish you didn't ask me this question. I've been in a fight with my mom for the last 24 hours. I did not watch, and I am an Anglophile. I love everything British, I'm telling you.
You're kidding. You're one of the royal people that you love the royals.
Oh my! Well, not so much the royals, but the stories. Like, I love the BBC more than anything.
The BBC? Nobody loves the BBC.
I love Britcom. I can't help it. I love British drama. I love British dramas, British dramedies, all of it.
I had no plans watching the royal wedding. Unfortunately, at 5 a.m., my dog Wrigley woke me up on Saturday morning. So I do the whole deal. Anybody that has pets, I mean, sometimes your dog just doesn't stop. So I got out of bed at 5. Fed him, took him for a walk. I turn on the TV, not thinking, and all of a sudden, there's the royal wedding. I mean, it was wall-to-wall coverage. They showed the wedding, and then they repeated the wedding. I've watched it 3 times yesterday, and then my wife DVR'd it. She didn't have time to watch it in the morning. So I watched it three times. Times yesterday. Whatever you need to know about the royal wedding. Here's the thing. If you didn't want to watch the royal wedding, you started watching, you got sucked in.
Which is why I did not watch. Every time I saw something that even looked like it could be wedding related, I turned. On SNL, I didn't even watch that one skit. That's the time I decided, oh, I'm going to jump up and take a shower.
I thought SNL was great last night.
Was
with all
it?
The celebrity cameos,
hilarious.
And they did a spoof on the royal wedding. But here's my question. Why was Oprah at the royal wedding? Who does she know?
I don't know. It's because I couldn't be there.
Do you just invite Oprah? You know what? We need a huge celebrity. Let's just get Oprah.
Well, how do you not invite Oprah? Like, really?
George Clooney, Amal Clooney. Okay, Amal may have some connection, maybe, but I didn't really see it. James Corden is English. The Beckhams were there, Victoria and David, but they kept going back to Oprah, and I'm thinking, why? I don't get it. Why was Oprah there? 312-981-7200. Janet, you're on WGN. Janet?
Yes, hi.
You watched yesterday?
I did. I got up at 3:30, took a shower, drove to my girlfriend's house, and a bunch of my book club girlfriends, about seven or eight of us, watched in her bedroom in our pajamas and pearls.
Oh, so you didn't get dressed up. A lot of people got dressed up yesterday.
No, because I would have typically watched it from my bedroom, so we all wanted that bedroom feeling, so we all kind of stayed in comfortable clothes and pajamas and just watched in her very comfortable bedroom and had a wonderful time and watching. We loved it.
Did you tear up at all?
Oh, my God. The way Harry looked at Meghan, yes, I teared up. And then with her, when her mom was sitting there by herself and just kind of getting teary, definitely teared up at that, too.
Meghan Markle's mother sat by herself right on the pews were on the side. If you're, you know, it wasn't a traditional church. They were right. It was like stadium seating. Okay, so you have this big, long aisle.
I think that's where a choir normally sits. I think that may be where a choir normally sits.
Well, she sat by herself. I thought it was interesting that she didn't have a sister or any type of relative that she could sit with. She was just there by herself, and I thought she handled herself so well the entire week,
very
but
classy.
Yesterday at the wedding.
Very classy, yes. Very. But my girlfriends and I said the same thing. There's nobody there for her. But we just thought she handled herself so with such dignity and class.
There was a moment during the wedding where they were doing a song, I didn't know it, from Princess Diana's funeral. And Harry started singing along, and he teared up.
Yeah, he was probably remembering his mom.
Wow. I hate to admit this.
Yeah.
I had no plan, so watching, and I got sucked in. I mean,
It was an historic event, number one, and it was just a love story. It's a love story. It was just absolutely beautiful to watch.
What is it? The prince marries an American girl, and they go off and live in paradise. That's how it is, and we all want that story, don't we?
I am such a hater.
We all want that.
That is
fairy
the reason
tale.
Why I didn't watch.
I really, you know what? Had it been any two people in love, I think I would have watched anyway. But the fact that it was on this scale. Just magnified the love story even more.
And Harry is such a likable guy, isn't he?
You know what? I have never found him physically attractive, but he is a very, he's like a guy you want to hang out with. He just seems like a very, even though he's a prince, very down to earth, very comfortable, very just kind of, a guy you just want to have a beer with.
Well, he wears his heart on his sleeve. And when I think of Harry, I think of that picture of him when he was helping the kids. I think it was 2 years ago. It was a picture of him, and I think it was taken in Africa. But he's with just 15 or 20 kids surrounded by him, and he's just smiling from ear to ear. What do you know about William?
Yeah.
You don't really know much about William except he's, you know, he's going to be the future king. But you know Harry. He was this wild kid. He got his act together. You know, he started donating his time to charity, and, you know, here he is, married a biracial, divorced American. Who is?
Yeah, I know, and that's the history making, which, you know, we just thought was just absolutely phenomenal.
I got sucked in, and I got to tell you, I really enjoyed it.
Well, I'm glad you did. Welcome to the rest of humanity.
Thanks, Janet. Have a
Thank
great day. 312-981-7200, our phone number, also our text line. I watched the wedding, then I went and worked out, and I came home, and the TV was on, and I don't know why I got sucked in again. And then we do our thing in the afternoon, you got kids' activities. Then at night, my wife wanted to watch it, and I watched it again. So if you, I feel like I'm now an expert, Pam.
Okay, so what was
I think I lapped you.
I got a question then.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, in turning, like, watching other news stories and looking around today, I saw them. I saw him open the door for her at this blue car. What was that blue car? I was interested in the car.
I have no idea.
Okay, so somebody
You were going to ask about the blue dress because there was a huge moment because remember when Pippa was grabbing Kate's train and everyone was talking about her rear end.
Mm.
So yesterday it was Meghan Markle's friend that was wearing a blue dress. I want to say she was from Canada and everybody started talking about her rear end on Twitter. And
oh, so did she have one? Rear end?
She did. It was it was very nice.
Oh,
I mean, for research purposes, I was looking at her rear end just to compare with Pippa's from, whenever Kate got. All right. It's time for a break, isn't it? All right. Let's take a break. 312-981-7200 at 720 WGN. Pete McMurray in the Allstate Showcase Studios. There's a guy that just walked past the studio wearing a pea coat. You can't wear a pea coat in May. I don't care how cold it is. You can't do that. You just can't. Ugh. Winter coats. This is the time of year where we all get angry because we want to lay by a pool or we want it warm for Memorial Day. We want to be able to barbecue. And if it's like this next weekend, people are going to fight. We're just going to be very upset. Oh, boy. It's rough stuff. 312-981-7200. I have a question for you. Are you tired of tipping? Because I am. I am so. Ben, you're shaking your head. Yes. You're tired. You went to the movies today. Was there a tip jar at the movies?
No, there was not.
There's a tip jar everywhere I go. Tip jar at Starbucks, hot dog stands. My kid plays sports. Everywhere I go, there's a tip jar at the concession stands. I don't remember that growing up.
I definitely don't remember that. I don't even remember concession stands when I was growing up.
I mean, there's tip jars everywhere, and people want tips for everything they do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
So today, my son was playing in a basketball tournament in Aurora. And I walk in to pay my fee, which I think it's going to be $3. By the way, $7. Okay. All right. I get it. You got to make a living. But then there's a tip jar by the entrance that says struggling college student. I'm thinking, well, you're working here. You're getting paid. You can't have a tip jar there by the entrance. Pam?
Where was this again?
This was in Aurora at a basketball tournament at the entrance.
Oh, yeah.
You can't have a tip jar when you're collecting money.
No.
Yeah.
No. The two don't mix. No.
Have you checked your Starbucks app? When you pay with your app, it gives you an option to leave a tip.
Oh, I don't pay with the app at Starbucks. Yep. No.
But they also have the tip jars. So do you leave a tip if you go to Starbucks? Even if you don't drink coffee, you probably stop there and get some food. Do you leave a tip?
Mm.
Even though they're doing their job, that's what they get paid for.
Yeah, but how much are they making an hour? You know?
Yeah, I consider that service industry. So,
okay.
If I'm paying cash, I'll definitely leave, you know, leftover change or, you know, something of that
nature.
Yeah,
me too.
Leave the coins.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would probably be less likely to pay through the app though if the app includes a tip thing and there's a tip jar, cuz I mean, come on, there is a limit.
There's a tip jar at the car wash. Do you tip at the car wash?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I do too. What if you take your car in and the guy that is driving your car into the little bay, do you tip him or the woman?
That's hard.
Do you tip that person? Mm. Or you're picking up your car and they drive your car around. Do you tip that person? 312-981-7200 is our phone number, also our text line. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. Do you tip our people out here? Our security people, do you give them tips?
I would like to, like, a couple times a year, give a gift.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Well, a couple times a year.
Well, you know, like at Christmas.
Yeah, like
you know,
Starbucks card or something.
Something like that. Yeah. You know, start of the summer. I don't know. Like a couple times a year. Christmas would be the obvious one. I'm trying to think of another one. I don't know. Maybe 4th of July. I don't know.
I did it Christmas, but other than that, I don't think so. Right? Mm-hmm. How about your paper carrier? 312-981-7200. Sure, you do it around the holidays, but are you doing it during the summertime? Are you doing it in the dead of winter when he or she has to deliver your paper?
No, that's what the holiday. That's what the holiday tip is for, kind of.
Does it bother you when they deliver your paper and they have the envelope in the paper, in the, you know, stuck in the newspaper, so you know where to pay, or it's a reminder to give them a tip? I just feel like everybody has their hand out. And I'm not saying that I don't tip. I do. I tip every single day. I'm tipping.
I get taken advantage of. I tip all the time.
But today, when I'm walking into a basketball tournament and I see the tip jar at the entrance, that set me off. It really did. 312-981-7200. Shelly! Shelly, turn down your radio.
I just did.
Okay.
I am so aggravated with tips and tip jars, you have no idea. First, let me tell you, these days, I had an old career, big professional career, lots of money. These days, I drive Uber Eats delivery. The lack of tip shocks me because I spent my life, if someone brought me food to my door, I'd tip them.
Right.
I tip 10% at the hairdresser, if I ever go, but I don't tip the owner. That's the old rule, because the owner got both sides of the chair price, but the employee didn't. You tip at a restaurant, 15%, maybe 20, 25, depends on the service.
Right.
15. But I do not ever tip at a counter. They get paid, standard account. That's the job. You're vending a product right there. I would not tip a person at an entrance like you just described at Aurora. It's as though the economy has become, I get more just because. And that's just not the way it's supposed to be. And it makes people like me and possibly like you unwilling to tip where we might have just because.
Right.
Since you're demanding one.
When you, Shelley, when you have food delivered to your house, how much do you tip? 10, 15%?
I don't actually go by percent. I'm more of a, if I like the person or not, $5, $7, $10.
Gotcha. Okay.
You know, it used to be a buck or two. And I remember my father still, you know, parking garages downtown where people parked your car.
Right.
I don't know if they still have those.
Yes.
And he'd be like, 50 cents to the guy who parked the car. And that was the normal tip figure in the 70s. And it was just so cute.
Well, parking has gone up a little bit since the 70s, Shelley, downtown.
Yeah, no kidding. $30, $40 to park. But they don't have quarters doing the parking anymore.
No.
I'm just saying, this whole counter person tip jar thing, in my opinion, is absurd. That's the job. That would be like handing money to the woman who goes to the cashier and checks me out in a Marshall Fields, which no longer exists, or in Target, or the person at Jewel who scans my food, any of those jobs.
Or they should have a tip jar.
Yeah, the same thing.
Got
no.
it. Thank you, Shelley. Okay. Appreciate the phone call. 312-981-7200. Let's go with Caleb. Caleb, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hey, how are you? Just calling in. I'm a college student. I work on a bagel truck. And we do have a tip jar. I think the point of that is so you just have that out there. So when people pay in cash, you just kind of throw other coins or whatever, $1 bills in there.
Right.
So I really appreciate that. I will say, though, yeah, the tip in for giving out money or what you were saying earlier with your son's basketball tournament, I'd say is not right. But I think as someone who works on a truck, it's appreciated.
So you work on a food truck, and are the tips pretty good?
Yeah, they're not bad. On a busy night, I'll walk away with $15 to $20 probably.
Okay.
In tips and singles, yeah.
See, again, service industry, you're providing a service, the whole food thing.
Right.
I think people feel compelled to tip, but you shouldn't see
right.
a tip jar at the entrance of a basketball tournament. Thank you, Caleb. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Debbie. Debbie, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hi. Last night, I had Pizza Hut delivered. Our order was $22. I gave him $25, and he gives me a dollar back. That, to me, and I don't mind tipping like a dollar, but that was ridiculous.
Wait a second. He gave you a dollar back just assuming he would take his own tip? You can't
right.
do that.
His excuse was he didn't have any change. And I'm like, excuse me? In fact, I called Pizza Hut and talked to the manager, and they said, you know what, you're right. We're going to talk to the driver.
Wow. All right, thank you. Thank you, Debbie.
Okay.
Here's a question for you. How much do you tip your food person if they're delivering food to your house? I mean, on average, $30, let's say. What do you tip, 10%?
Depends on how far they're traveling, because you know how far it's coming these days,
right?
You know, to deliver. So,
well, everybody has a radius, you know, certain radius that they'll only deliver to.
So if I know how long it's going to take them to get to my place and they're hustling, you know, I'll do 20-25%, because, you know, there was
25%.
Yeah, depending on
a $30 order.
Yeah, well, depending
on how
quick.
You're a single guy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what are you ordering? You're ordering probably $20 worth of food.
Well, it depends on the day, you know.
Damn, man. I mean, I usually tip probably 15% if someone's, you know, a pizza or something.
Yeah, I always
feel guilty, though. I'm like, did I tip that guy enough?
See, I worked in the bar industry for a long time.
So did I.
So I base it on the service I'm getting. Yeah.
What if you have bad service? Are you tipping?
I'll still tip, but...
10%?
Yeah.
Only 10?
Yeah.
You never leave a penny?
I've never done that. Because
if they have bad service, they'll leave a penny just to make a statement.
If somebody's belligerent to me, you know, in their service, then I would probably do something of that. But they're at least still putting an effort in. You know, everybody has a bad night. They have too many tables or, you know, something of that nature.
I get that. But they shouldn't be rude to you. I mean,
Agreed. That's where I feel I would be justified in leaving a penny if I did that.
That's a deal breaker. Yeah. We were at a place 2 weeks ago, and it took 40 minutes to get a drink.
Oh, wow.
Took our waitress 15 minutes to show up. And I get it. I know. It was a Thursday night. It was absolutely packed. But 40 minutes to get one drink?
Yeah, that's a long time for one drink.
And then once she showed up after 15 minutes, we ordered everything at once. So it would just show up. It's like, we know you're busy. We're going to order right now. And it still was an hour and a half experience. It was rough stuff. 312-981-7200. Talking about tipping. If you got a question or comment, 312-981-7200. 720 WGN. Pete McMurray in the Allstate Showcase Studios. We're talking about tipping. I went to a basketball tournament, and there was a tip jar at the entrance today. And I'm like, I'm done with it. 312-981-7200 is our text line, also our phone number. This is from 847 area code. I work for DoorDash food delivery, and some of the app asks you, and some of the apps ask you to tip before your food arrives, which is wrong. I did not know that. I would never do that. Absolutely not. I would never do that. 608 area code, we were talking about bad service. Do you still tip? Bad service, penny in a water glass. 219, people who deliver should get gas money from the business they deliver for because they don't always get decent tips from those who they deliver to. Thank you, 219. I agree with you. Let's go to Tony in Schiller Park. Tony, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hey, Pete.
What's happening, man? Go ahead.
Hey, Pedro.
Go ahead, Tony.
So here's my story. Restaurant last week, the owner comes up and says, we have a special free glass of wine with your order. And I said, okay, great, I'll take it. Bill comes. The wine wasn't free. And so I just said, excuse me, didn't you say something about a free glass of wine? And she's like, oh, no, that's, you know, for certain entrees. Didn't take it off the bill.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, so...
Did you leave a tip at the end because of that?
Big zero on the tip, my man. Big zero.
A big zero on the tip because she steered you in the wrong direction. Thank you, Tony. Let's go to Roger. Roger on WGN. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Go ahead, Raj.
Okay, you know, you're talking about tipping, and I don't even believe that you even thought about a tip after you waited for 45 minutes for a drink. I wouldn't wait 45 minutes for the next bus, let alone a cocktail.
Took 15 minutes and then 40 minutes for our drink to arrive, and we knew it was going to be a bad night. You know, you just have that feeling. It's like, should we get up and leave and then go somewhere else, or should we just stick it out? And it just turned into a painful experience.
Hmm. Well, then I hope you didn't tip anything, because then you should have left a note for the manager.
I think I did. I did talk to the manager on the way out.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you ordered a drink in 15, and you got it in 45.
40. Yes.
40. Oh, I'm sorry about the 15.
I'm sorry, too. Thank you, Roger. Let's go to Barry. Barry, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Go ahead, man.
Yeah, so 15 minutes, you know, if you walk into a place that's really packed, having been in the industry myself for a long time, I get it. I get the long wait in a crowded place. But, you know, if the waiter or waitress excuse themselves for leaving you for a while, that's one thing. But for them to, like, ignore you or not, you know, apologize, that's completely inexcusable.
They did apologize and say that they were down a server and it was jam-packed.
Yeah. Yeah, well, in the restaurant's jam-packed, you know, that's not always just the server's fault.
Right. I understand,
you know,
that.
Management is supposed to be, you know, there to help. And if management is not helping the servers play catch-up, then that's as much the management's fault as it is the server's fault.
Right. How many times have you been to a great restaurant where you see the manager or the owner bussing tables to get things moving along and helping out?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They get it. Thank you. Thank you, Barry. Have a great night. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Ann. Ann, you're on WGN. Hi.
Yes, so thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I live in Chicago. I pay property taxes. I pay utility taxes. They're so taxed, we're going to have to be begging for money on the streets. They're already begging for money on State Street. We're going to have to sit and watch these rich European tourists, like they do in Europe, Asian tourists. We're going to have to be begging money.
And we're talking about tipping here. We're not talking about taxes.
Tipping. Mean, we have no money. We have to ask for tips. We have to ask for begging for money.
I got it. Thank you, Ann. Okay. Ann's out of money. She's not tipping anybody. Listen, I'm overtaxed. I get so much tax, I can't do it. I'm done with tipping. You have to tip people. I mean, you know, what are waiters and waitresses getting paid? Absolutely next to nothing. That's how they make their living, on tips. And I completely get it if a restaurant is packed. But you have to service your customers, just like Barry said. You know, how many times have you walked into a great restaurant where you've seen the manager busting a table to move things along, or the owners? That's how it happens. Thank you for your call. Phone number 312-981-7200, 720 WGN. All right, it's 506. 312-981-7200, our phone number. Deadpool 2, $125 million over the weekend. I haven't seen Deadpool 1 yet. I feel like I'm behind with the
suit. Do not watch that with your kids, dude.
Really?
Just saying.
Yeah, do not. Do not.
Is that the one with the frontal nudity?
Woo! It was all kinds of stuff in there.
No. Deadpool 1 did not have the frontal nudity, so to speak.
I had to close my eyes and close my ears so many times.
Wait a second. Why? Is it dirty? Does he swear a lot?
There's lots of swear, lots of adult content.
Yeah. Lots of double entendre that's not so double. Like, it's just in your face.
So,
like,
Ryan Reynolds' Deadpool 1 did great. So they made a Deadpool 2, which opened this weekend and made $125 million.
Yeah.
And you've seen, Ben, you've seen both of them.
Yeah.
You saw Deadpool 2 today.
Correct.
Which one's better?
Oh, tough call, because the first one was so wanted and needed in the comic universe.
Now, what does that mean?
Really?
That's not the first time I've heard that. We needed something like this. What does that mean? The
comedy and the R rating that comes with Deadpool humor, it was
very sarcastic. He's a dirty superhero, but he's still a superhero.
He's an anti-hero, so he's a hero that does good, but he's not necessarily the best of guys,
which we like. We like the naughty anti-heroes nowadays, don't we?
Yep.
Was it a good movie?
I thought it was great.
Is he still saving the world? What's he doing? Who's the
pretty much
who's the evil person in this one?
Brolin. Brolin plays Cable.
Oh, that's right. Josh Brolin. Yeah. He was the evil person in the Avengers movie and Deadpool 2. Yes. If you're looking for a bad person, Josh Brolin's your guy.
Yeah.
There he is. Premise of the movie, what? Is he saving the world?
Short version, because I don't want to put too many spoilers out. Brolin's character comes back from future to try and alter, you know, time. And Deadpool's got to stop it from happening. In process, he's trying to save a teenager's life.
Are you two superhero movie people?
I am.
Pam, are you?
Yeah, somewhat. I'm not like deep into it. You know, I'll go see Batman. I like, you know, if there was another Superman, I'd watch that. But I'm not into like the green, whatever that thing is. What's that character?
The Green Lantern.
Yeah, I'm not into all those.
Wait, wasn't Ryan Reynolds the Green Lantern?
Yeah, he
that
was.
Failed miserably.
It
I thought
it was terrible.
Okay,
it was terrible.
But there are some people who love them all, and I don't love them all.
Black Panther.
It was phenomenal.
What?
Yeah. It was great.
Am I missing something? Because I watched half that movie on a flight last week. And I'm like, yeah. Granted, I was hungover and I was flying back from New York, but it was...
Yeah, try again. Yeah, try
really?
Again.
Really?
Yeah. I can't watch any movie hungover.
Hmm.
I mean, since the comic universe has started to hit the cinematic, you know, scene, there are certain characters that everybody just wants to see, you know, on the big screen now.
Black Panther, though.
Black Panther is one of them.
Really?
I mean, he broke a whole bunch of barriers.
Like what?
He was first African-American superhero.
Okay.
So that was a big one. Part of the crossover from creating, you know, the characters and the heroes from that region of the world.
So I need to give it another chance.
You have to buy into like the whole cultural story too. I mean, it's more than just
maybe that was it.
It's because, like, you know, on some levels, it's the same thing when we see like toys come out for some of these things. You know, there could be a Wonder Woman, but you know, maybe in the black community there'll be a black Wonder Woman, but she's basically a white doll played in black. This story was not like that. There was a whole backstory that was cultural in nature, and I think that's where people took their, you know, their pride from, and you know, even people outside the culture are like, whoa, wait a minute, this is different. This is kind of cool.
So Star Wars opens next weekend. I've seen the last two. I thought they were good.
I'm real excited. With Ron Howard at the helm.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Really?
Uh-huh.
What was Ron Howard's last good movie? I feel like his last four.
For me, there was nothing better than Apollo 13, so...
Yeah, that was 25 years ago.
I know, but I'm the aviation geek, so... That was the end-all, be-all.
But I don't think he's made a good movie in years. I know he did a few documentaries, but has he made a good movie? You can't screw up doing the story of Han Solo for Star Wars on Memorial Day weekend.
Well, you can, because you have the fanboys out there, you know, and if the storyline isn't right, everybody's going to, you know, rip everyone involved with that film.
Are you going to wait in line for tickets? I mean, are you going to...
I'm not going to wait in line. I think I'm going to see it Tuesday afterwards, because I've got a pretty full weekend with everything else.
Does it open on Thursday?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll try to go see it Thursday afternoon. I like to do the matinee.
I love doing matinees. That's what I love doing it today, to go see Deadpool.
Is Carrie Fisher in Solo?
No. Because this is
an
earlier story.
That's right.
So pre-episode 4, you know, the original Star Wars that came out.
So is there anyone we know in this movie?
No.
Mark Hamill? Does he make an appearance?
Not that I know. Not that I know.
I feel like Mark Hamill's been turning up everywhere, and for some reason he's on my Twitter feed now.
Really?
He keeps showing up, and he's actually pretty funny on Twitter. So I started following
I've heard that. I've seen some of his social media in the past, and it's always been entertaining.
Well, May was a big month for him, because May 4th be with you, and then he had a play off that, and May 20th, I can't remember what it was.
And correct, I have to look this up to be 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure he just had a appearance on Big Bang Theory, too.
He did.
Yeah.
For the wedding, which was big, and a big bang.
Still haven't seen it. But,
so, Deadpool 2, you highly recommend it, Ben. You just saw it this afternoon.
If you like Deadpool 1, you're going to love Deadpool 2.
Do not see this. I mean, don't get duped into it.
Pam, I'm glad you told me that, because I have a 12-year-old, and I was thinking, okay, maybe I need to watch.
That 12-year-old will dupe you into watching it. Hey, Dad, let's watch Deadpool. All my friends have seen it. They say it's cool.
So
it's
rated R, right?
Yeah.
You're going to be explaining a few things.
God, now I want to see it.
I saw it with my nephew, who is a freshman in college this year. I think we saw it. When did Deadpool come out? Did I see it 2 summers ago or last summer?
I think it was two years ago.
Two years ago.
So, you know, we watch all action movies together. That's the thing we do together. Like, he saves these movies and we just watch them all. Like, everything. So I just thought it was going to be another action movie. And they're starting to tell these jokes and I'm like, You need to fast forward that. Like, I am not going to watch this with you sitting here. This is really gross. Okay.
Is there any other superhero movies coming out this summer? I'm sure there are.
Oh, yeah.
There's one every month. What's the next big one?
I have to look at the release date because I forget if it's June or July, but Ant-Man and Wasp comes out.
Wasp? Ant-Man is, what's his name?
Paul Rudd.
Paul Rudd.
Yeah.
Who plays Wasp?
Evangeline Lilly.
Wow.
What about action movies?
So she went from Lost to Wasp. She only does one-word movies and TV shows now.
Yeah, I guess so.
Evangeline Lilly. Yes. All right. Do you want to go get Russ and we'll bring him in next?
Yeah. Yeah, I can.
Okay. 514, Sunday. Our phone number, 312-981-7200. That's also our text line, 312-981-7200. It's Pete McMurray in the Allstate Showcase Studios on 720 WGN. WGN, Pete McMurray in the Allstate Showcase Studios. Our next guest, I want to call him Coach. He has coached basketball for his entire life. And then one day he said, forget it, I'm going to start writing books. This is his fourth book. He'll be appearing at LitFest coming up in a few weeks. The book is entitled All the Dreams We've Dreamed. It's Russ Bradbird. It's great to see you. Thank you for coming in, Coach.
Thanks, Pete. Good to be here.
You know, you look at me and you say, wow, McMurray's a two guard. He's a shooter. I appreciate that.
I'd say point guard height, maybe, and point guard skills.
Why do people say that? I mean, I'm 5'10". I can shoot from the corner.
Enough. You're big enough.
This book isn't really a feel-good book. I mean, it's a very serious book.
That's right. All the Dreams We've Dreamed sort of chronicles the killings that have been going on around Marshall High School basketball, and it starts with the tragic mistaken identity shooting of Sean Harrington, the
who we know from Hoop Dreams.
Yes, well, he had several cameo appearances in Hoop Dreams, but he was a well known basketball player, an all city basketball player, and a great college player. Went back to Marshall. That's part of the tragedy of the story. Is he did everything that society could ask a guy to do. He graduates from college, and comes back to make a difference. He's a good comes back to Chicago to be a good parent to his high school girlfriend was pregnant after college. He comes back to be around the kids, helps to raise the kids. He does everything society asks him to do, and he gets screwed.
And then, besides that tragedy, some of the players start getting killed.
Yes. So after Sean was shot in January of 2014, and then in succession, six players have been killed that had all played basketball for Marshall. And now, Pete, here's the real bomb, is that it appears, now I don't want to name someone, but it appears that another Marshall player was killed yesterday.
What?
So I don't want to say a name. It's all over Facebook, but I just don't feel like it's my place to.
Right.
So that would make the seventh Marshall basketball player. And they're just in a tragic spiral. And it's almost always been players that are done playing basketball.
I mean, you grew up with basketball your entire life, and you know the game, so you're writing from a basketball point of view, but you knew Sean. How did you know him?
Yes, well, I'd grown up in Chicago, as you know, and I was doing a scouting service in Chicago before I got hired at New Mexico State. So I'd seen him play quite a bit in high school, and then when I went to New Mexico State, as a recruiter, the first thing you need is who's going to be your point guard. So
right.
we went after Sean Harrington and got him. So I knew him from his days as a point guard at New Mexico State, and was completely out of touch with him. But then when I heard in 2003 his own mother was killed during a home invasion, a botched burglary attempt at the neighbor's house. She walked in just checking on the neighbors and walked into this horrific scene, ran out the door, but was killed on her way out the door. So he's been wrecked by gun violence.
Sure.
And so that's one of the remarkable things of the story is that, he's still been able to go forward and work, start these anti-gun initiatives using basketball. But it's a pretty disturbing story.
I mean, what compels a person to keep moving forward? I mean, when so many tragic events like that happen in your life.
Well, one of the things in the book, All the Dreams We've Dreamed, in the book, one of the things that the central themes of the book is the way Sean and I see the world differently. He sees God's hand in some of this, and it's something that he deals with on an everyday basis. And one of the amazing parts of the story was that when he's driving his daughter to school at 7 in the morning in this mistaken identity shooting,
and he was shielding his daughter. by the way.
Dives on top of his daughter.
And he gets shot.
A bullet goes through her headrest. I mean, can you imagine? Goes through her headrest, but he takes one in the back. And so he's paralyzed because – so just a really astonishing act of heroism. Like, and I'd like to think, you know, well, I'd do that. I have a daughter. I'd do that for my daughter. But would I do that when the bullets start flying? Would you do that when the bullets start flying? I don't think we really know until we're under that kind of pressure. And, for a long time –
I think it's a parental instinct to just shield your kids from anything.
I think that's a big part of it. But to think that quickly, to push her down, I think was pretty – but I also think part of it is you grew up around gun violence all the time.
Right, so you know.
And you're a little more seasoned. You don't panic the way maybe I might panic. I've never seen someone pull a gun and shoot it other than television.
Right.
And so I think
a lot of us are the same way.
Exactly. And so but that's what's remarkable about the story is his heroism in saving the daughter.
All the dreams we've dreamed. Russ Bradbird in studio with us. Arne Duncan, who was the former head of Chicago Public Schools and the former U.S. Secretary of Education of the United States, gave you a quote for this book.
Well, part of that's one of the interesting things about the book is that Arne Duncan, you know, we could not seem to get Sean Harrington's job redefined. See, Marshall's not wheelchair accessible. And people kept saying to me, well, you got to find Arne Duncan. He can help. And so, I was calling all kinds of government agencies and well-to-do people that I knew or might have contact. But as it turned out, I could have got his phone number a year before through all the Chicago coaches have his number.
This is Chicago.
Yeah, right.
You're one person away from exactly. Arne Duncan's phone number. You can get Obama's phone number in about 30 minutes.
I know, but in the basketball community, everybody has Arne Duncan. It just didn't occur to me that all the coaches would have his number. So finally was able to get through to Arne Duncan. And so he's taken a strong interest in Sean's story and then provided the quote for the back of the book.
What compelled you to write this book?
This is
your fourth book.
Yeah, I could not stop. You know, I was at first I was advocating for Sean. It just drove me crazy. Here's a guy that is an American hero, and he did something that if it had happened in Iraq or Afghanistan, he's on the front of newspapers and magazines. He does it on the west side of Chicago, and I felt like it was being ignored. I think one of the things that happens because I live in Chicago only in the summer, I'm not as immune to the violence as a lot of people are. And so at first I was advocating for him. And then I tried with the writer Alex Kotlowitz. I was saying, hey, Alex, you got to do a story on this guy. We'll get it in the New Yorker or the Wall Street Journal. And he finally said, Russ, you've been bugging me about this. Why don't you write it? And I thought, you know, I go to bed at night thinking about how can we help Sean Harrington? I wake up in the morning thinking, how can I help Sean Harrington? I thought, screw it. You know, I'll try and write this one myself. So it was 3 years. The shooting happened 4 years ago, but the aftermath, as you can imagine, there's no getting over this.
No.
You know, the aftermath will go on forever.
So you had to spend some quality time with Sean.
Yes. Because I'm in Chicago in the summers. I teach at New Mexico State. And so I was with him. I'm with him, you know, every few days in Chicago. I'm with him. So long interviews with him, long interviews with other people. And I should say he doesn't agree with everything in the book, which is part of the book, is that, you know, this different take on what went down and what happened and how things have evolved.
But you got to tell me, when a guy like this experiences so much tragedy in his life, what keeps him motivated? What keeps him going?
Well, that's what I don't know.
Because a lot of us would say, you know, that's it. I just can't do it anymore.
He has remarkable resilience, but it's also been very damaging to him. You know, it's one of the things that I'm concerned about is his day-to-day health. You know, it's one thing, you know, it's his day-to-day health and getting his exercise and getting his therapy. And now that he's been able to go back and start work at Marshall, but at one time, rehab was when his insurance ran out. Rehab was $850 a day. Now we can do fundraisers from now until
Kingdom
Come. Isn't
that ridiculous? That's just crazy.
Yeah, and how are we going to pay for $850 a day of rehab?
That drives me crazy. We saw a shooting Thursday at Dixon High School. We saw the shooting Friday in Santa Fe, the high school at Santa Fe in Texas, Parkland, Florida. What do we do? What is the next step? I don't think anybody has the answer, but we need to start moving towards something.
Pete, if you would have asked me 3 or 4 years ago, I had all the answers. But now that I've just been working on one guy's story in Marshall High School, one guy, Sean Harrington, one school, Marshall High School, I feel like I have less answers. You know, like I started off thinking, these damn police officers. Now, I saw that, you know, the cops caught Sean's shooters pretty quickly. And there used to be 120 murder detectives in Chicago, and now there's 80 of them. So, no, I get that the cops aren't perfect, but it's a complicated problem. One thing we could do is integrate the schools. I went to an integrated high school. I went to Von Steuben, which is an integrated high school. But the school system is segregated now, and there's a sort of an underbelly of, you know, there's the great schools. There's Whitney Young and Von Steuben and Lane Tech and that kind of thing. But there's also an underbelly of poorly performing schools.
Sure.
There's the charter schools that have devastated the public schools. There's because the, you know, the, so that it's changed the neighborhoods, and the closing of schools has been a disaster. And so one of the things I've learned is an unsolved shooting really ruins a neighborhood. Can you imagine in, you know, I know we live close to each other where I'm at in the summer. We're not so far away. And can you imagine if in Old Irving Park or North Center or something like that, a shooting happened and it is just never solved. And another shooting happens and it's never solved. And last year, 95% of all the shootings went unsolved. Not all the murders, but all the shootings. And I just, it's hard to fathom that all these guns are going off and no one is ever charged with anything.
Right.
And so, but it's complicated, and it's, I'm wary of anyone who has a simple solution. So I decided in the book, in All the Dreams We Dreamed, I don't have any answers. I just present one person's story, and I think people will take it differently. I've gotten letters, you know, letters from military army guys saying how much they appreciated the story and Sean's heroism. Sure. But there's other people, there's peace activists, I think, that love the story as well. And I think that, you know, I think by only telling one person's story, I think I sort of enlarged the story.
When are you at LitFest?
Well, LitFest is Printers Row LitFest is June 9th and 10th, and Sean and I are going to appear with Rick Kogan, who I know you know.
I love Kogan.
He's a hero to so many of us. I'm sort of a journalist now.
Well, he's the Chicago Treasure, first of all. He knows everybody in every single story, but that voice.
Yes, but what about, he's also Herman Kogan's son, if you know your history. But so we're appearing with Rick Kogan on Saturday, June 9th at 1 p.m. at Printer's Row. It's going to be Sean Harrington and myself and Rick Kogan, sort of a panel discussion about the book and about gun violence in Chicago.
I love this. I'm going to keep you around for another segment because I want to talk basketball, too.
I'm all yours.
Russ Bradbird is here. All the Dreams We've Dreamed. They can get the book just about anywhere, including Amazon. All right. It's 720 WGN. is our phone number. Pete McMurray in the Allstate Showcase Studios. Our guest is Russ Bradbird. All the Dreams We've Dreamed is his fourth book, a story of hoops and handguns on Chicago's West Side. It is a story about basketball and guns and tragedy. It's a rough one.
Yes.
But it is Chicago's reality now, isn't it?
Yes, but also courage and endurance, I would say. I mean, there's not much uplifting about the book, Pete, except Sean Harrington's mindset, his personality, and the things that he's done. He started this Hoops for Peace Chicago tournament with a great player named Jimmy Sanders, a former retired player. And they do it. They're Hoops for Peace Chicago. Every player gets, you know, usually you go to a tournament and they give you a trophy. Every player gets a book. Who's going to weigh books at tournaments? But they did voter registration, organ donor information, and every player got a book at the tournament. It's just an odd idea. So their idea is to try to use sports as sort of this tool to as a lure, you know, because basketball is so popular in the community,
right?
And if they can use it for voter registration and that kind of thing,
the
idea is it's a big positive.
Can you tell people about Sean that have never heard of him?
Well, Sean Harrington, he was, as you know, he played at Marshall and he appeared briefly in the Hoop Dreams movie. A lot of cameos. He didn't have a starring role, but he was I think he was a sophomore in the final culmination, the final year of the film, but. He went on, played at New Mexico State and then Northwest Missouri State, got his degree before the tragedy, before he was shot. And part of the amazing part of the story is that he was not a teacher. He was a educational support personnel, essentially a teacher's aide in special ed. So he had this magical touch with the kids. There's a story in the book about no one could reach this autistic kid, but yet Sean was able to, even though Sean hadn't been trained to work with autistic kids,
right,
and had never met an autistic kid, but here's an autistic kid, go try and talk to that kid. And within a year, Sean had sort of got him out of his shell and convinced him to run, are you ready for this, for Homecoming King, a kid who just sits in the corner all day, a year before wasn't even speaking to anybody.
I love that.
Runs for Homecoming King.
I love it.
Rallies the students to vote for him, and then convinces the star of the boys basketball team to back off and don't tell your friends to vote for you. And then so this kid winds up winning, the autistic kid wins Homecoming, just changes his life. And so Sean had this magic touch, I think, with people where he was able to get to people, for teachers and students and other, and one of, so there's that kind of charisma where the janitors love him, but the principal loves him as well. And Arnie Duncan loves him, but the kids on the street love him. I mean, he's got that kind of personality and that kind of charm that he can talk in a lot of different languages.
It takes a special person to be a coach and a teacher. I really believe that. And, you know, Sean has that gift. There is some type of connection or some type of drive that these people have.
Yes, but I will also say that his empathy and his sympathy for the downtrodden kids at Marshall and the hard luck stories and that kind of thing I think all that's great and hugely important, but there's a danger to that too, because I think it really, really, you know, there's been six kids killed, maybe seven as of last night. Six of his players have been killed, and I think it really, you know, a more callous guy would react differently.
Right.
And so there is sort of that danger is, you know, I think it's true for all of us, Pete. You know, his strength could also be his weakness if he's not careful, and we're all like that a little bit.
Right.
It's, you know, and so what makes us good at something can sometimes be our undoing. Very sort of, is that Shakespeare? I don't know. I should know. I'm an English professor. That's
yeah,
very
you're
Shakespearean.
The teacher. I'm just a radio host.
But that's part of the story of all the dreams we've dreamed. In the book, it talks about that quite a bit. Is that you know, his compassion and empathy, but also, you know, there's a danger to that. As kids keep getting shot, you know, it keeps, like, he doesn't go to the funerals
right.
anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I hate the fact that we're used to it in Chicago. I mean, on average, what is it, 20, 25 shootings a weekend?
Yes.
And we're used to it, and it's not even summertime yet.
I've had school administrators tell me that Sean Harrington's story is a good story because he lived. Well, that to me, that's a real, that was very upsetting to me to hear the idea that this is a positive story and a real story, and I mean, a positive story, and that there was that somehow it was some kind of happy ending because he was alive.
There's no happy ending.
Yeah, and I think we've become a little bit immune to it, and it just has to stop.
Russ Bradbird in studio. All the Dreams We've Dreamed is the name of his book. You've been a coach for how many years? I know you're retired now.
Well, I'm not quite old enough to be retired, but I coached in college Division I basketball for 14 seasons, 8 years at UTEP, the University of Texas, El Paso, where I worked for Don Haskins, the sort of the famous coach from the Glory Road kind of movie and that kind of thing. And it was actually Tim Floyd who talked Don Haskins into hiring me. Tim was an assistant coach down there. So I was there for 8 years and then at New Mexico State for six. And then in the Irish Super League, which is the lowest level of pro basketball in the world.
Wait a second. But, that sounds like a made-up Chicago league.
I was
the Irish Super League.
Well, there it was. So I was, which is, that's my first, the first book, Patty on the Hardwood, was about my time coaching.
Sponsored by Cork and Kerry.
There it is. Uh-huh. But I coached my team into last place in the Irish Super League. So that was my first book. But so there's 14 years. And then I decided I want to try and write, you know, I want to try and write and be a writer. I always loved books. And it started for me, Pete, with the Sports Illustrated Book Club. You know, they used to have this book club where they sent you books. So the first book I got was David Megacy's book. Do you remember this book? It's called Out of Their League, and he had quit pro football to work against the Vietnam War, and it made a big impression on me. Like, he had been on the St. Louis Football Cardinals, you know, and
right.
He quit pro football at the height of his career, and I thought, well, that's an interesting. And so right away, I had this idea that sports was not just about the games. And then working for Don Haskins, who started the first five black players to win a national championship. And so I got, you know, and then worked on did the Nolan Richardson book, and he was very political and outspoken. And so I've had this idea for a while about sports as this agent for social change and also this barometer. You know, if you think about it, the greatest voice for peace in American history was Martin Luther King. You wouldn't get much debate about that. He came out against the Vietnam War in 1967, but Muhammad Ali had done it a year earlier.
Right.
And that was when things started to shift in, you know, in the American consciousness. Kids started protesting the Vietnam War, and now there's more conscientious objectors. And so, and even Jackie Robinson desegregated Major League Baseball in 1947, but it wasn't until 1949 that the U.S. military did. So baseball was the leader. And so that's often been the case, especially in racial progress and gender stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's often been sports at the forefront.
When did you graduate from high school?
I can't remember. It was a long time ago. 1976. The bicentennial class.
That's right.
There it is.
I went to Bradley University. Coach Versace was there. He had the best record in college basketball in 1986. 32 and 3.
Yeah, something going into the playoffs, yes.
They win their first game in the tournament. They lose to Louisville, and Louisville goes on to win the national championship. And,
yes.
Of course, Coach Baroni was there.
Yes.
What is your connection with those two? Because you know those guys.
Well, I went and worked at their camp. And we're talking about this connection between sports and books and literature and art. And, you know, for me, Dick Versace was really a very early model. Like, he was interested in theater and movies and books and politics. And he was just a very much sort of broader kind of, he had a much broader view of the world. And
after basketball, he ran down in central Illinois.
Well, that was a step backwards, in my opinion. But no, running for political, I'm joking. But he was really a model in some ways. And he was very different than Tony Baroni. You know, Tony was basketball.
Oh, yeah.
And Dick was very much, you know, saw it sort of as part of a bigger story in the wider world and the human condition and that kind of thing. But that was I found that very inspiring and very interesting that here was a guy who didn't eat, sleep, and drink basketball every minute and was still a successful coach.
Right. I mean, I love the Missouri Valley back in the day. You had Bradley ISU, of course, the war on 74, Wichita State with Xavier McDaniel. Sure. He went to Wichita State. And Tulsa, coached by Nolan Richardson, and you wrote a book on him.
Yeah, the book 40 Minutes of Hell. It actually got turned into an ESPN 30 for 30. And so, but I found Nolan to be, you know, I just thought, well, here's a Nolan Richardson. I saw him to be a guy that's a political figure first. And so when I approached Nolan and I said,
very political.
Yeah, I said that if you want someone to write a book like they would about Lute Olson, you know, Lute Olson or Jim Calhoun or Rick Pitino, I'm not the guy, but I convinced him of, and not that he had needed much convincing, but that I thought his place was as a political figure. I would say the same thing about Dorothy Gators, the great Marshall girls coaches. She's won over 1,000 games. She's the greatest, maybe one of the greatest coaches in American history, regardless of gender or sport. But I see her as a political, a symbol of political and social progress. And when she took over at Marshall, they had 4 games a year. And now she's won 1,000 games. Like it was a club sport. And so I'm very interested in the, you know, I could tell you a lot of Don Haskins stories and Nolan Richardson stories. I can't recall any of the plays that we used to run or the winning baskets or the score. I just never found that stuff as interesting, but it was the stories behind all that.
Nolan Richardson was one of those coaches that was bigger than life.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And Don Haskins too. And I think that's where we're headed with Sean Harrington I've talked to Sean about this, is that his life now stands for something greater than you played at Marshall and now you coach at Marshall. Now his life, you know, it's true in a lot of aspects of, you know, whether it's Abe Lincoln or Martin Luther King, mm-hmm. and now Sean Harrington comes along, and his life means a lot more than what might look like at first glance.
You coach D1 basketball. I love seeing the mid-majors in the tournaments. What do you think of college basketball today? Are there too many powerhouses like the Dukes of the world?
No, I was delighted that, you know, of course, for Loyola's great success.
How great was that?
Yeah, and so I was delighted for that, and I think just the sort of the, if you lose a game, you're out of it, then anything can happen in a single game. So I think in general it's not in terrible shape, but for me the conundrum is it's free market capitalism for the coaches, and for the players it's amateur sports. And I think it's just, I don't know how they can continue doing things both ways, where I know at New Mexico State, if you send your kid to New Mexico State, Pete, they're not even going to meet a professor till they're a junior. They're going to get taught by adjuncts and instructors and people who don't have health insurance, and then when you're a junior you get a professor. That's true at nearly every major American university, is that the coach is making $5 million a year and your kid is being taught by a $25,000 a year adjunct. That's a bad system. And now that I'm on the other side of things, I'm on the academic side of things, I see the danger in that. Like, it doesn't make sense to me that not just that the players at Louisville don't get paid, but that the English instructors at Louisville or the, you know, intro to history instructors are not making a livable wage.
Well, that's happened for years, that teachers don't make enough money.
Yes, that's right.
That's the problem.
But it's, now that I'm on the academic side of things and I've seen the now New Mexico State's actually in fairly sane. Our coach only makes $400,000 a year or something like that. But there's something wrong with the system.
I mean, which is insane money just to coach basketball, if you think about it.
That's right. But he's one of the lower paid major right. coaches in America. So that idea that it's free, a free market for the coach. Mm-hmm. You know, like I teach writing classes now, and if one of my students had a best selling novel, we wouldn't say, you can't keep that money now, you're an amateur. I mean, it's a funny thing to do. I think it's a funny thing to do. And of course, the dynamic is complicated because of race, is that, you know, most of the players are black. And so I don't like the slavery analogy that the Duke mother said. I think that's too much of a hot button thing to say, that it's just like slavery when you're, you know, getting a $70,000 scholarship to Duke and 10 pairs of gym shoes a year and that kind of thing. But
you're getting everything free.
But a whole industry has sprung up on the backs of these kids.
Where sure.
There's people who have made have a lifetime career, and the players get 3 or 4.
And now you have sports betting, which is going to be legal in every single state.
Makes me cringe.
Yeah.
That makes me cringe.
I love this town. I love that we're an amateur sports town. I love watching high school basketball. I just love it. I watch high school football, but high school basketball, I love it. I've become friends with Tommy Kleinschmidt over the years, and it's so much fun
yes.
to follow them around and watch their games, you know.
Well, you should have saw him play. He was a great player.
Still has the shot.
Oh, is that
right? I challenge him all the time. I go one-on-one, full court, because he can't run anymore.
I'll bet. But yeah, it's I've said for years my favorite thing to do when I lived in Chicago for many years, of course, and I would, when I was doing my scouting service, I'd go to there's some public league games start at 3:15 and some start at 4:30, and then there's the night games in the suburbs or the Catholic League, so you could see three games a day on a lot of days on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you could see three games in a day, and that was really great. And I would just as soon go to a good high school basketball game in Chicago. It's the great. I mean, the cheerleaders are so soulful, and the players are so intense, and it's just
God. There's so much passion in the crowd.
And I think now that I'm a writer, Pete, I get that every game is a story. Here's the beginning of the story. Here's the middle of the story. Here's the end of the story. And so there's a big analogy with the beginning, middle, and end that happens in the drama and the players and the ups and downs that I still find very compelling.
I mean, there's a reason that Coach K comes here every year and plucks kids out of, you know, the inner city.
That's right. And let's not forget, he's a, you know, a Chicago, you know, hard scrabble kid.
He went to Weber High School.
Yeah, in Wicker Park before it was, you know, when you could still afford it.
He comes back every single summer and sees his brother, who's a retired fire chief.
I didn't know.
Yeah, every single summer he's
back
here.
He never looks me up.
I've seen him once in the last 10 years, and I begged him for an interview.
No, I've never met him.
It's great to see you.
Yeah, good, thanks, Pete.
So you're going to be at LitFest again? Can you mention to people when you're going to be there?
It's June 9th at the Printer's Row Lit Festival, June 9th at 1 p.m. with Rick Kogan and Sean Harrington. But there's a couple smaller ones before that. May 30th at the Bookseller. Seller is C-E-L-L-A-R. The Bookseller on Lincoln near Lawrence. That's on Tuesday, May 29th at 6 p.m. And then City Lit, which is a great bookstore in Logan Square.
Mm-hmm.
That's on Wednesday, June 6th. And Sean Harrington will be at all three of those events. So you might not want to meet a hack writer like myself, but to meet somebody like
Sean.
I'm not kidding now. To meet Sean Harrington, it's really has a real charisma and power that people need to interact with.
For people that know high school basketball, I mean, he was a name. I was talking to Ronnie Fields the other day, who trains kids.
Sure.
And talk about a guy. That's another story.
Yes, and somebody should be writing that book. I'm not the guy to do it, but somebody should be writing the Ronnie Fields. You know, it's a pretty good documentary.
Because he was destined for the NBA, and then he gets in a car crash and breaks his neck, and that was it.
Yes.
He was over.
He may have been the best high school player ever. I know people say Ben Wilson, but Ronnie Fields, I think, was right up
there.
He's a sensational leaper. I've never met Ronnie Fields, but I admired his game, and his high school coach, Wolf Nelson. Is Farragut and Wolf Nelson are an important part of this book, the new book.
We could talk for another 45 minutes,
right,
but I got to let you go. I got to give a shout-out to Jack Silver, a mutual friend of ours. Jack grew up in Chicago. You went to school together, and Jack was in radio, who I met years and years ago, and he's never hired me, ever.
Well,
you need to talk to
lucky.
Him about it.
Oh, no, you want to be hired by him.
Well, probably not. No.
Now, Jack's a dear friend, and he's the guy who introduced me to basketball back in sixth grade.
Really?
Yeah.
Jack doesn't have basketball skills.
Oh, he was the best sixth grade player in the city. But he had hair down to the middle of his back,
and he hasn't grown since.
Hair down to the middle of his back, and I think he liked the rock and roll music better. But he was a very good player, and played at Von Steuben. He wasn't a great player at Von Steuben, but he was the best sixth grade player I've ever seen. I mean, he could shoot a lefty layup. Who can shoot a lefty layup in sixth grade?
We were all great grammar school basketball players. Russ Bradbird, all the dreams we've dreamed. Really appreciate you coming in.
Thanks, Pete.
It's 720 WGN.
O'er the land of the free. And
WGN. Our next guest has been singing at Ditka's for years. The world finally discovered him when he started singing the anthem for the Cubs, and that was Game 4 of the World Series. It is John Vincent.
That national anthem was like nails on a chalkboard.
Let me tell you something.
I sounded horrendous, and I'm not kidding. I sounded like, I wish I could swear, but I can't. I sounded like that.
I wanted to play that because... You're at the World Series.
Yeah.
Singing for the Chicago Cubs.
Yes, my childhood team growing up and everything. Yeah, oh yeah.
I was excited for you so much, and I just wanted you to paint a picture for me. You're walking out to do the anthem after the NLCS. I mean, you were off the charts excited.
I was off the charts excited. Everything was happening. You know, it just was one thing after the other, and it was surreal, and it was... just the moment didn't rush by, though. It was very, it just kind of went by nicely. So I was able to appreciate everything, getting the excitements of the, you know, the games and all that. But I had a horrendous cold after game six with that Dodgers game I did. So game four, the anthem, I hate hearing my voice no matter what.
But a lot of people
that
do.
Game four, yes, they do. Oh, no, a lot of people hate hearing mine is what I'm saying. After that game four World Series one, I cannot oh, God, did I sound bad. I sounded really bad.
Do you remember the score of that game?
We lost.
Yeah.
We won the when I sang the against the Giants, and then the two games against the Dodgers, mm-hmm. against Kershaw. I was able to spend some time with Kershaw this past summer. He was such a great guy. And then we lost that game I did in the World Series, which...
We lost game four. That was the game I went to. Yeah. And I had surgery, and I had a wheelchair, and I was in the handicap section.
Yeah.
And you walked past me, and you stopped to talk to me, and you said, hold on a second. Eddie Vedder was tapping you on the shoulder.
Really?
Do you remember that moment?
I
was with God my brother Almighty. Dave, and I could barely stand up. I was in so much pain, but I had to be there.
I think, you know what I was doing, honestly, before going to do that anthem? I was in my suit, and I was standing in the shower in the locker room there, or one of the get green rooms, and letting the steam hit me the whole time. So I'm fully dressed in the shower with my suit on, because I was feeling like dog crap, and wow. I was just hurting, and everything was so surreal. And if you look, I almost take a step back because I thought I was going to faint, and then I got the text from everybody at Lady Gaga text about me.
I wanted to ask you about
boom,
that.
Boom, 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 boom. You know?
Lady Gaga was so moved by you singing the anthem that she tweeted something.
Yes, that was very, very kind of
her. I mean, how big was that?
For her to do that is incredible, because I'm nobody, man. I'm nobody.
And
for her
you're to do somebody that, in Chicago.
I'm nobody. I am nobody. Just a guy from the South Side. I'm just a screw up from the South Side of Chicago whose parents were born in Italy and met here. And, you know, I was blessed that I got lucky. That's it.
And the Cubs win the series, and they say, John Vincent, of course he's going to get a ring. And you're wearing it right now.
Yeah.
That could go on my leg.
Yeah.
That's how big your paws are.
I mean, you know.
I mean, this thing is huge. Wow.
What they did, Mr. Crank Kenny, Mr. Ricketts, and the Cubs organization, and everybody there from Theo Epstein to, I mean, Joe Maddon. I've become good friends with Joe.
All right. Can I bring this up? Because I was at the home opener, the first game of the season, and it got rained out, and I was in the Cubs offices, and you walk out, and we start talking, and then Joe walks by.
Yeah.
And Joe stops, and he grabs you, and you guys kiss each other, and you whisper something to each other in your ears, and then he goes on his way.
Yeah.
When did you become such great friends with him?
It just started like, I'm going to say the first year he started managing there, I just started doing the anthem and then said hello to him. And then we just started talking more. And I don't know. It's just a connection. I think Joe is one of the, like, it's unbelievable how zen he is. I don't know if you watched the game today, and there was a terrible call on Schwarber. And you see that pitch?
It was I was at my son's basketball tournament, but I heard about
catcher,
it.
Catcher, face mask high, and Schwarber, all these guys in the Cubs, like, and I sound like a homer saying this.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are really nice guys, from Rizzo to Bryant to Bias to all these guys. Like, and I've hung out with Schwarber, and just nice guys, really nice guys. And Joe manages, like, so zen-like. He is so zen-like. He's cool, Joe. And he got me so calm before game six. It's amazing. That I told him when we had dinner the other night, I'm like, you don't know how much an effect you have on me. Like the way you go with life during the moment, living in the moment, not expecting so much. And he's humble. He's kind. His wife, Jay, is amazing. And, that whole team and organization is like that. And I'm not kidding.
Really?
I'm not joking. I mean, it really is. And, Joe, I just clicked with him. I just did. And I go to Pennsylvania and I sing at his event in Hazleton. And he, drove me around the town, and it's me and him in a Suburban. He's like, Johnny, this is where I grew up. This is the apartment. This is where my mom worked.
He never forgets his roots. That's what you love about Joe Maddon.
That's what I love about Joe.
Yes.
I'm my mom and dad, born in Italy, met here. I grew up on the south side of Chicago by Archer and Cicero, and that's where I'm from. And that's Ronnie Coomer, who's the Cubs announcer.
Sure.
You know, I said to him when he was playing with the Cubs, I go, I know your grandmother. And he looks at me like I'm crazy. because he was sitting with Coach Ditka, Mrs. Ditka. This is in 2002 or when he, wherever he was playing. And I go, she makes the best upside down pineapple cake in the world. And he goes, holy. He goes, you do know my grandmother. And I actually used to cut his grandmother's grass when I was a kid because she lived next to my Auntie Carmela and my Auntie Joseph.
Oh, that's Chicago, of course.
Right?
Of course you did.
By Midway.
Yeah. Yes, upside down pineapple cake. No one makes that anymore. My mom still makes it. I love it.
Oh,
with the pineapples and how juicy it is.
Oh, yeah.
Singer John Vincent in studio with us. How long have you been at Ditka's?
17 years.
Jeez. How did you meet the coach?
I was a recruiter in a county of finance, and my sister Lisa says, Johnny, you kind of sound like Sinatra. I said, okay, what do you want me to do? She goes, why don't you try to sing? I'm like, you're nuts. You know, I got a job in accounting and finance. This is it. This is what my job's going to be. I didn't love it, but I loved the man I worked for, Doug Christensen at Chemical Personnel Search. I sang at his memorial 3 years ago. It was an inspiration to me. And he would talk to me because I suffer from depression, anxiety, and obsessive compulsive disorder. And he would spend time and talk to me and tell me about life and tell me about things. Like there's these people that come in my life that mean so much that I listen to. And he was one of them. Joe Madden's one of them. There are a few out there that just, you know, Marty Gatilla, who was one of the owners of Tavern on Rush, just passed away.
Yeah.
And Marty was just such a beautiful man. What a great man. And the things you can hear from these people and listen to. Anyways, going back to what I did, my sister says, why don't you try it? I started messing around at Rosebud, did another place. Ditka's had about four or five singers they would rotate through. Coach Ditka and Mrs. Ditka gave me a four-month deal. Then they gave me a year and then a lifetime.
They signed a lifetime deal.
Yeah.
I love it.
I got lucky.
Oh, my gosh. I love your posts on Facebook. And you love life. You cherish it. You really do.
I love life, and I struggle with life, though. I think we all do. Really happiness, but I get really, really down.
Well, I want to talk to you about that because I saw your segment on WGN Channel 9.
Yeah.
You were bullied as a kid, and you talk about how you went through anxiety and depression. And how do you deal with that? And first of all, I love the fact that you're talking about it because you're helping other people. I mean, there's somebody listening right now that's saying, God, I suffer from depression. I don't know where to turn. What do I do? Just start talking about it with people.
Yeah.
Definitely.
One of the things that, my mother and father say, it's that old school Italian things, you don't have to say everything. You know, it's like you want to be tough. You don't cry. You don't do this. You don't do that. You know, you don't show your emotion. I think that, especially in the world today, if we wear our emotions on our sleeves, then what are you going to attack me on? I already told you what my weakness is.
Right.
Is. So if you want to attack me on it, great. I already know I have that. Now, I'm 6'5", 300 pounds, and if I'm kind to somebody and I do something kind, people say, oh, he's a big teddy bear. My problem is if somebody's smaller, if a woman's kind, they see it sometimes as a sign of weakness, and I hate that. We should see kindness as compassion as the only way we should live.
I agree.
I'm far from perfect. Don't get me wrong. I'm an a-hole many, many times, and I'm so far from perfect it's not even funny. But I do truly believe as I get older, the key to life is kindness, and that's it. That's it. That's all we have. We're gonna be gone. In 100 years from now, me and you, nobody's gonna care. We're gone. It'll be a whole new set of people here. 100 years ago, in this spot on Michigan Avenue, it was a whole different set of people, a whole different set of problems.
You got to make a difference right now.
All there is now. There's no future. There's no past because the past was the present moment when it was happening. And if we're lucky enough to get to the future, it's going to be the present moment when it gets here. So anything we could always do if we're going to save money or lose weight or do this or whatever, it's always done in the present moment.
A great friend of mine, Billy Bush, who has gone through the ringer with everything, is a very religious man. And he always says to me, and he'll send me a text out of the blue, and he'll say, be anxious for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, my God, I love that. Where did you get it? He goes, it's from the Bible. Be anxious for nothing. Don't dwell on the past because you're going to be angry. Don't look to the future. It's going to make you anxious. Live in the present. Live in the now.
Yeah.
And one of the things that you're doing, talking about being bullied as a kid and depression, is you're talking to kids. And you were at Homer Glen Junior High?
I was at Homer Glen Junior High, and I was at Gooding's Grove and Homer Glen, both schools that my nieces went to. And my niece, I went there and spoke to both schools, one right after the other.
And there was a kid that got up and said something to you.
There was a kid that got up, and I thought he was going to say, and it took so much guts, I thought he was going to say, I got bullied, because nobody was really wanting to come up. When you go to the younger kids, they all want to talk. When you go to the high school or junior high, they're more, there's like 600 kids in the auditorium. Nobody really wants to go up there.
No.
This kid walks up, and I thought he was, like, that was pretty cool that he's coming up there. And I thought he was going to say he got bullied. He said, I was a bully. And he goes, my friend David taught me how to not be a bully. And his friend David waves in the audience. And I'm like, holy cow, man, you just taught me something today. I go, well, that's powerful.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Right.
You know, because I went through a part of my life in my 20s and 30s where I was angry. I was angry, man.
Yeah.
I wasn't happy. I was angry. And now I suffer. I get depressed. Don't get me wrong. But there was a time when I was angry. And I was angry for getting taken advantage of. I was angry for getting beat up. And it stuck with me. And what does it do? It doesn't want you to, you don't want to open up and be happy because you're guarded.
Right.
At some point you say, okay, wait a minute. I'm human. I'm going to die one day anyways. So am I going to just keep being angry or am I going to let this go?
Good for
you.
I
talk to a psychiatrist. I go to a psychiatrist. I talk. And when I was at my deepest point, I went every week. And I go to him all the time. He's fantastic.
Do you know when you're starting to hit a low?
And, oh, yeah.
What happens? Oh, yeah. What do you do? How do you get out of it?
There used to be, you know, for me, it was a lot of escapes. If it was food, if it was gambling, if it was whatever, you know, maybe sometimes drinking. And now you realize I lost 130 pounds. So what is doing it for me now is exercise and lifting weights. But the other thing is being in the present moment. This book, The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle, is such an amazing book.
Sure.
He actually talks about being the watcher of your own mind, the ego, which is the human mind, and having the inner spirit, you know, the inner body being the watcher of your mind, the human mind. Because our human mind is, we're all afraid. We're all afraid.
Mm-hmm.
We're all afraid. We're all imperfectly perfect. We're all screwed up. We all got our problems, man.
Some more than others, like me.
Like me. I got a ton of them. I got a ton of problems. I'm just, you know, I get in my own head and forget it. Forget it.
I think a lot of us are like that.
And you know what the problem is? We beat up ourselves. We beat up ourselves. And that's why I say if we look at each other and we just say, we're all in this together. Because in reality, all these people that are walking on Michigan Avenue, you really want to get down to the nitty gritty. We all came from the same person. All the way down the line in history, we started somewhere.
Sure.
So in actuality, right. we're all connected.
Right.
We're all connected.
I got to tell you, you're one of my favorite people. You're always, every time I see you, you're always so positive and just warm and just inviting to talk to. And I thought we'd talk a little sports here. Yeah. I didn't think we'd get so deep. I love this.
Well, thank you.
This is what I love about talking to you because you're such a deep person. People know you as the guy that sings.
Yeah.
Yes. But this is good. You're helping people.
Well, it helps me because, like I said, I struggle. Man, I struggle. I get dark. And when I get dark, you know, a lot of times I see Robin Williams, and I'm like, man,
yeah.
I see the connection. I was watching The Birdcage today, and he was making me laugh. And I'm like, how the blank did he, you know, do it? Why did he give up? And then I'm looking at Mrs. Doubtfire, and I'm laughing, and I'm like, oh, my God. And then I read something. I looked him up today, and it said, you know, the people that want to make other people laugh are the ones that are struggling the most.
Right.
Because we know how bad it hurts. So what do
the
we
sad
do?
Clown. That's
yeah,
what they
the
say.
Sad clown, you know.
And I mean, there's so many comedians. You got Jim Carrey, who suffers from anxiety and manic depression.
Yeah.
Robin Williams.
One of my favorite, Chris Farley.
Farley, yeah.
I loved Chris Farley.
Everybody loved Farley.
You know, Farley. Yeah, everybody loved Farley, right?
Yeah.
And he was his own worst enemy. He's like, you know, and I read something, I don't know if it's true or not, about him having OCD. And I'm like, I'm wondering if that was true. And it was like, if he stopped doing drugs, he would then like be eating 5 hot dogs. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh my God, that's me.
Right.
Except if it, not with the drugs, it was, you know, gambling. Or then I'd go to my food or whatever. And I'm searching for that escape because I want to numb myself.
I think a lot of us, we have that dark time. I know I do, especially lately. I feel like I've been there.
Why?
And just, you know, it's just life, and you're running through life, and, you know, I'm married. I have a wonderful wife, but if I don't connect with her, it's like, what am I doing? I'm just going through the motions.
Well,
and you get down on yourself.
That's when we got to get right
That's
now.
When you got to tell yourself, hey, I need to reconnect with my wife. I got to get going and got to do this. And you got to keep moving.
That's when you tell yourself is that all I have is now.
Yeah.
Pete, all I have is now.
Right.
All I can do is right now, right?
John, be anxious for nothing.
Yeah. I mean, you do. And you're right. When you look at the past, either you're longing or you're regretting. When you look at the future, you're nervous, you're contemplating, you're getting like, oh my God, if you live right now, we're not guaranteed. Like, see, they asked the Dalai Lama, what is the biggest tragedy of humanity? He goes, man. And they go, why? Because he works all his life to make all this money sacrificing his health.
Yep.
Then when he gets older, he uses all this money to recuperate his health.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is he never really lives.
Right.
Right? I'm always thinking about, am I going to make it? What's the next thing I could do? Oh, my God. Okay, can I do this with a song? Can I get it to the next step? Instead of saying, I'm right here right now. I'm in WGN studio. I'm talking to a great guy. It's beautiful. I'm seeing people walk, a lady smiling right now. We're waving to them. And we're here right now. That's
live,
it.
Live in
we,
the moment.
We're not guaranteed. See, we think we're guaranteed
yes.
moments. We think we're guaranteed the next day and the next day. None of us are.
I'll say one more thing before I take a break, because I have these things that I call, I check in with myself, and I'll say it in my head. I won't say it out loud because I'm always anxious to get somewhere. Oh, you got to do this. Yeah. Like today, I was at my son's basketball tournament, but I was thinking about the show, and we went on early today because the Sox ended early. I'm like, God, I'm going to go on at 4:30. We only have material for 2 hours. I'm like, you know what? Just let it come to you.
Yeah.
Just talk about life. Yeah. And people started calling in, and here yep. we are.
That's it.
You got to just let life come to you sometimes.
You do.
You do.
You do.
John Vincent in studio. When are you performing at Ditka's?
Tonight. I'll be there.
All right. Tonight and Friday and Saturdays, right?
Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I will be there tonight. I go out of town Tuesday, but I should be there Thursday.
Okay.
But I most
likely, most yes, weekends you're Thursday, there Thursday, Friday, Friday yes. and Saturday. Yes. This is what we're going to do. We have SNL, the experience tickets to give away. We're going to give away a 4-pack of tickets. Nice. And what you're going to do, we wanted you to sing today.
Yeah.
So we're going to have you sing cartoon theme songs.
Okay.
We're going to get caller 7 on the line at 312-981-7200. Caller number 7. You'll win a 4-pack to the SNL experience at the Museum of Broadcast Communications if you correctly identify the 3 cartoon theme songs that John Vincent will sing coming up next on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, we have John Vincent who sings at Ditka's. When are you singing the national anthem for the Cubs again?
I think my next date is June 7th.
June 7th.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'll make a point to be there. Well, let's see, the 9th is a Saturday, so the 7th is a Thursday night game or afternoon game?
Afternoon game. I think it's a Thursday at 1:20 if I want to.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll try to make that. I like the afternoon
yeah,
games on
too.
A Thursday.
Me too.
It's good stuff. All right, let's go to Rob. Rob?
Yeah, how are you?
Say hello to John Vincent.
Hey, John, what's going on, Brent?
How are you, sir?
Good, good. I'm very inspiring talk you did.
I mean, I just told him off the air, one of my favorite talks I've ever had on the radio in my entire life. Now, we got to get John to sing, so we thought we'd have him do cartoon theme songs. If you get all 3 correct, we'll set you up with a 4-pack to the SNL experience at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Okay, are you ready for the first one?
Yeah.
All right, John, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, whenever you're ready, go ahead.
He's a dog that solves crimes in a van. His best friend is Shaggy.
I don't know, Scooby-Doo?
Okay.
John, theme song?
Theme song, yeah, he got that one. Do the next one, is that where we're at?
Can you sing a little Scooby-Doo?
He just, yeah, Scooby-Dooby-Doo, where are you? We've got some work to do now.
It's funny because I feel like Sinatra is singing Scooby-Doo. You sing.
Actual lyrics to the music, you're just making up lyrics.
Well, I had to make up the lyrics because it was started out as Scooby-Dooby-Doo. So.
All right, the next one, here we go.
Prehistoric family. They're a modern Stone Age family from the town of Bedrock. There you go.
The Flintstones is correct. Number 3?
Number 3 is meet Mr. Future, his boy.
Elwood.
Oh, you're good. Yeah. Meet George Jetson, his boy Elroy, daughter Judy, Jane, his wife.
That would be the Jetsons.
The Jetsons is absolutely correct. Boom. Nice job,
awesome.
Rob. Congratulations.
Awesome.
Hold on, my friend, okay?
All right.
All right. Picks up a 4-pack SNL experience. John Vincent, I love you. Thank you for coming in.
I love you, too. Thank you so much
I'm so
for
glad
having me.
We had this talk. And do you have a website people can go to, Facebook?
Facebook, John Vincent. I have Twitter. It's JohnVincent72 and also Instagram, JohnVincent72.
And what size is your ring that you're wearing?
It's a 17. Because I'm a big, fat monster. I got to lose some weight.
You're a big guy.
I'm going to break this chair in about a minute. I'm going to be a ba-boom right
John
there.
Vincent, everybody. It's 720 WGN. WGN in studio with us. Our next guest is a travel expert. She was just on the front page. Let me say this again. The front page of the travel section of the New York Times with her piece, A Roadmap to Shopping Like a Royal in London. She just got back from London yesterday. It's Amy Tara Koch, it's so great to see you.
Hey, Pete. Jet lag. You know, who can deal with jet lag? I just wanted to come and chat with you.
I love your London pictures. I love you on Instagram. And every time we have you on, I like to bring it up because every picture is so artsy. It's just not, you know, two people standing in a bar toasting. It's very artsy. And you had a picture, I want to say today, was it of the cake?
Yes. Well, it's funny. And my next story in the New York Times is about a neighborhood called Dalston. And I was working on that while I was there after I kind of shot some video in conjunction with that Times piece. And the cake came from that East London neighborhood that I was researching, which is a gritty neighborhood about 30 minutes from central London. And I thought it was so cool that Meghan and Harry had picked that baker.
Why are we so fascinated with the royals?
You know, it's interesting.
People here in America, I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, it's not even just the royals. It's specifically the British monarchy.
Yes.
And it's because I think after Diana, just her boys had so much friction with the real world. She took them to see the homeless. She took them to department stores out for pizza.
Right.
And they really felt a connection to, you know, the plebs like us. And what's more interesting is that for Meghan Markle, I mean, she represents the true fairy tale. And she made so much of her biracial identity. She was woven into this ceremony that is just so astounding to people. I read in the Times today, a little girl said, "Mom, that the bride's mother has hair like you."
Oh gosh!
So it was just
we were talking about how brave the bride's mother was, sitting by herself, being broadcast all over the world. She handled herself with so much grace. During that ceremony,
absolutely. And I mean, she only had one member of her family, just her mom. I mean, being under that level of scrutiny is so intense. But it's so interesting. Just this, Meghan. I feel personally that Meghan and Harry have made the whole monarchy so modern and so much more compelling and so relevant to so many walks of life.
Right. Definitely.
So it's fascinating. And it's going to be interesting to see if she is forced to tame all of her opinions because she's quite outspoken, which I applaud.
It's interesting because I heard yesterday that she's 36 years old, which I didn't realize. And Princess Di died when she was 36.
Oh, I didn't even know that. You're
I thought she was much older.
You know, she married when she was 20. That's why.
She was only 36 when she died, Princess Di.
Yeah. She married at 20, and the boys were so young. So that's interesting. I thought she was older, but you're right. She would have been 36.
Instagram all this weekend, women dressed up for the wedding. I love that they got dressed up.
Yeah, again, it's like Kate and William have made the monarchy young and relevant and interesting also because she was rather a plebe herself, you know, she was an aristocrat, but certainly not noble, Kate Middleton.
Mm-hmm.
But then you look at Meghan, who, as the pastor said yesterday, was the child of slaves, if you want to kind of go that deep.
Right.
And so people are just super, super excited that it's not this stuffy, boring, you know, all white, monarchy. I mean, I went out to dinner in London with my friend Debbie Lilly, who flew from Chicago just to go to Windsor.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, people flew from Americans.
Well, you were just there. Tell me about the vibe over there.
Well, first of all, I lived in London for a year, and the sun came out four times in the entire year that I was there.
Oh, my God. It was so sunny yesterday.
I could not believe I landed in London, and I had 5 days of perfect weather and sunshine. So everybody was happy. I mean, the people from every walk of life celebrating this wedding and just all excited. And those cheesy souvenirs, I bought so many of them. Like, I got the Meghan mug.
Or you get sucked in, you know?
Get sucked in. I got the tea. And just in all of the newspapers, they're very snarky over there. And they were just trying to just pull negative things and stir up dirt, but nobody would have it. Everybody was very excited.
I'm married to a People magazine junkie. Her news comes from the National Enquirer, the Star, all those websites, TMZ. And she's been sucked in for weeks. And I'm a guy who loves waking up on a Saturday, watching SportsCenter, going to work out. My dog wakes me up Saturday morning at 5 a.m. I take him out, do his thing, and I turn on the TV. I got sucked in.
Yeah.
I didn't think I'd get sucked in, and I got sucked in. And then I went and worked out, and I came home, and they had the rerun on because NBC replayed it, and I watched it again.
I mean, it is, even as my story very tangentially was about the wedding, but it is such a fairy tale come true. This is an actress a biracial actress who meets him at the Invictus Games, right. Harry, in Canada, and they begin this courtship. And the fact even that the, now I just found out something interesting, the Queen had to approve the dress.
Really?
Yes. I mean, the Queen approves all of these things. And I think, I don't know, I think Queen Elizabeth has just mellowed with age and just wants Harry to be happy and settle down. I mean, he's been kind of a playboy.
Well, he's such a likable guy because a lot of people can relate. And, you know, his mother passed away when he was young. He was raised by his father. He went through the wild period. And then he found charity. And yeah. found his love and then the love of his life.
Yeah, it's just, it's such a beautiful story. And I think also the way that that wedding was orchestrated, it felt so effortless. And yet yeah. there were teams and
oh my
teams
gosh.
And yeah. teams of people. I mean, it was timed by the second, really. But you know what else I really loved? It's the tradition in British weddings is not to have bridesmaids as we have in this country.
Right.
And so she only wanted to be to have children. And I thought that was so touching. It was, it just kind of represented the next generation of life. And
sure.
it was just so, just a really interesting group of kids. And I read today that Harry brought over a young African, an orphan that he met while he was over there and had him come to the wedding.
Damn.
Yeah. I mean,
he's doing everything.
These people
right.
are just so likable. I mean, you look back, you know, to Wallis Simpson and,
I don't even know who that is, but
oh,
I'll agree with you.
Her, yeah. Well, Edward had to abdicate the throne because he fell in love with an American divorcee, and he did.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. I got to read up on that.
You got to read up on that.
Where can people follow you?
Amy Tara Koch on Instagram, Twitter, Amy Tara Koch, journalist on Facebook.
Your Instagram is fantastic. All right.
You.
You're a travel expert. Well, I'm going to take a quick break and we're going to talk about overpacking because we all do it.
Yes.
And is there anything over Memorial Day weekend where we can find last minute deals this week? Because it's coming up.
Yes. I mean, I'm such a planner and I advocate planning, but I have a couple of deals to talk about.
Awesome. We'll take a quick break and come back with Amy at 720 WGN. Amy Tara Koch in studio with us. Follow her on Instagram. She is a travel expert. And the biggest thing that we do, and I'm guilty of it, is we overpack. And you're going to tell us not to overpack and how we can underpack from now on.
Overpacking is the biggest waste of time on so many fronts. I've been victim of that before, and as my daughter who's sitting right here can attest to.
Brett!
Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. You can't bring every pair of shoes, every shirt, all of that. Listen, I just went to London and stayed in two fabulous hotels and I wanted to look amazing. So what do? I have a formula. You only bring a color palette of neutrals because a lot of black or a lot of white moving into summer. Then you, as a woman, you bring some accessories. You bring a scarf, you bring necklaces, you bring, I'm showing him all of my.
Right. Your accessories. You're wearing a lot of bracelets.
Exactly. You bring shirts that work with everything. You bring scarves. You bring one jacket and never, ever more than three pairs of shoes, ever, under any circumstances, because that eats up a lot of
now,
space.
Now, we've had this conversation where I do the carry-on, but I wear a size 12 shoe. So I have a pair of dress shoes. I have to have running shoes so I can work out. And one more pair of shoes. That's a lot. That's six pairs of size 12 shoes.
No, well, one pair, if you're,
I'll wear one
where
pair.
You're going. You wear one pair,
yes.
And one pair is a flip-flop or a sandal. So it's really, really light. So it packs flat. So here's the thing. You want to bring a carry-on suitcase, and it's good to get the type that expands just in case. I bring a carry-on and then a very small duffel. I bring the extra pair of shoes oftentimes in my duffel. But here, I want to show you my handy-dandy.
Okay.
These are called packing aids. I'm showing them to Pete, and they're by Eagle Creek. Eagle Creek makes these super, super thin nylon pouches that zip up. There's one for underwear, one for socks, one for shoes, one for shirts. And what they do is they compress your clothing and they push all the air out. So not only does it make it super easy, but then when I get to, which, you know, if there's a potentially skanky hotel, I can just put this right in the drawer and not
right.
have to unpack my stuff.
God, is that great.
So these, that's one trick. Here's
so it's very compact. Okay.
Super compact. Here's the other mistake people make. Beauty products and grooming products, full-size shaving cream, full-size soap, full-size shampoo. No way, never bring it. The Sephora actually has an incredible array, or you can just go to Amazon, but you want small, small sizes of a soap, of a shampoo.
Just go to Target.
wherever.
The travel section.
Exactly. Go to Target. But for women, you know, if you need like the nicer type of shampoo, I said Sephora is good. But yeah, Target is great. And then whatever I don't need, I leave anywhere I go. So here's the other thing. If I don't bring enough underwear, I just buy more.
And you can always buy things.
You always buy things. And we went to Japan last year for 3 weeks.
Because this is your job. You travel all over the world.
All over. And we brought a carry-on suitcase for every member of my family. And we just go to a laundry place, and I have them do my laundry. It's usually $20. Never the hotel. That's ridiculously expensive. You go around the corner. You find like a dry cleaner. And you're like, listen, how much will it be if I drop off my stuff and pick it up tomorrow?
God, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I've never thought of that because you never want to send it with the hotel because it's through the roof.
Right.
Walk around the corner.
You walk around. I mean, we've done this in every place I've ever visited. You go around the corner. Sometimes we bring a laundry bag or we just get a shopping bag or like, listen, we want you to do this. How much is it going to be? So that's another trip.
We got about a minute left.
Okay.
Memorial Day is coming up.
Yes.
Last minute deals. Where can people find them?
Okay. So I just checked Travelocity before I came in. You want to go to New Orleans? That can be a great trip. Savannah, Georgia, you know, it's so expensive to go to Vegas. I know you like that, or Miami. Savannah, Georgia is so much fun. It's so close. You can do kayaking through the marshlands. I found hotels in not so expensive and airfare for about $300. New Orleans, we absolutely love. And another one is Virginia Beach. This is a place that's kind of unexpected. You fly into Norfolk to
Virginia Beach.
Yes, I wrote about it for the Times, and they've got a boardwalk. They've got millions of beaches. You can do water sports, and it's all like clams and oysters and fresh seafood. There's a Hilton there. I'm just looking because I think it was like $200 right now.
God, that's great.
Yeah. And so
there are places that people can fly to.
You need to think of not predictable places.
Right.
Think of where people not going, where it can be sunnier than Chicago, which is freezing right now. So you can get some sun,
right?
Get some beach time and have food that's not going to be ridiculously expensive. So I'm going to say New Orleans, Virginia Beach, Savannah.
God, you're good. It drives me crazy that there's never deals to Las Vegas anymore.
It's funny.
Never.
It's funny. Right when you say, I can't stand Vegas.
I love
right
it.
When you said
I could go
it,
there every other week. I love it so much.
Well, you're right. It is really expensive. It was $500 to go.
Wow. Amy Terracotch, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
So good to see you. And people can find you on Instagram. Just type in your name.
@AmyTarracotch. Yeah, please follow the travels.
It's 720 WGN.